things are heating up in January. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
It is great to be back with you today. We're recording this on Thursday for this week. And I woke up this morning and I went from having about 4 inches of snow and ice on my driveway and in my yard to having a wet driveway. If you would have told me that that could have happened overnight, I would have said, no siree, Bob. Well, I've now seen it, so I have to concede that it can happen. Now, we have predictions of screaming white death for Friday in some circles. Now, everyone wants to believe the worst. I am a cynic, but I'm not necessarily a pessimist. From what I'm seeing on the radar map, it looks like we're going to get a lot of rain. And people are saying, well, that's a good thing if we get a lot of rain. Nope, the ground's frozen. A lot of rain right now means what? When the ground's frozen.
Lots of runoff because there's no place for the water to go.
Flooding. So we are in bad shape if we do, in bad shape if we don't. So there you go. Not to be gloom and doomy, but...
No. And again, you've seen these weather maps. One weather map says you're going to get a dusting or up to 2 inches. And the other weather map says it's 2 feet of screaming white death with ice, firmly mixed in like a parfait.
I think
it just depends on... But I saw one map, Chuck, that I do believe is absolutely correct. It was a map, and it showed, like, the whole Midwest with Ohio in the middle, you know, like they do, that whole, like, angled-looking thing. And the entire thing was in this, like, icy blue, and it said, across it, it said, precipitation in inches predicted 0 to 100.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, that's about the most accurate map I think I've seen.
Exactly. It's sort of like, we have no idea, dartboard broken. So whatever happens, happens. Yeah, I think no matter what happens, they're saying freezing rain. So
which is the thing. I mean, I would take 3 feet of snow over
freezing
any
rain.
Freezing rain whatsoever, ice. You know, because honestly, you can get around in snow, even heavy snow. But if you get a little bit of ice, I don't care if you're driving an all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, no-wheel drive, or you're actually driving a tricycle, you're not going to be able to outmaneuver big patches of black ice or pack ice.
Even with spike tires, you're essentially, it's a crapshoot.
Because none of us are ice road truckers.
That's right.
And if you notice, they jackknife just about as much as anybody else does.
More so, yeah. I don't watch that show. I've seen a couple of episodes of it. I'm like, well, how many more jackknifes and rollovers can I see? I mean... That's plenty, thank you. And watching trucks being pulled out of lakes and things is just not my idea of a fun way to spend an afternoon or an evening.
Yeah, it's
so
true.
Oh, but that being said,
so we do wish that because by the time this airs on Saturday, we will have known how much we're getting or is continuing to come down. So we wish that people would, you know, do the smart thing, stay in near your radios, listening to us, and watching the snowfall from the outside and enjoying a nice hot cup of coffee or your favorite beverage.
There you go. We'll be digging out by that time. So,
So Chuck, what I said, though, I mean, even though next week is supposed to be a deep freeze temperature-wise, things are certainly heating up in the month of January, and I don't mean this little
snap
we had that just melted off your 4 inches of snow at your house. Things are heating up all over the political map. As a matter of fact, here in Ohio, the heat is starting to boil off all of the, let's say, surface-level moisture, and we're getting down to what's in the core. And I mean that in as far as electoral races. Just last week, the front runner for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate, Josh Mandel, who's the state treasurer, announced that he was leaving the Senate race because of a major health issue that has occurred and is coming up with his wife. Now, they have, like, I think, 3 young children as well. And so he basically put out an announcement. A few minutes before he gathered his core team and told them, and then he put out an announcement publicly that his training, his belief system, you know, what he's been instilled by his parents and everything else was family comes first. And so because his wife is struggling with a malady that looks like it's going to take a lot of work to take care of, and we don't know yet what it is.
Yeah,
I've heard
a
couple of different things.
Yeah.
And I respect that. You know, you don't necessarily have to share all of your personal laundry out there when you make this kind of an announcement. But he basically said he needs to focus on his family, he needs to focus on getting his wife better. And so he's leaving the Senate race. Well, that created this massive gasp across the Ohio political landscape, and it's creating a lot of shuffling. Because Mandel wasn't alone in the Republican race for the U.S. Senate to take on Sherrod Brown, who's the current incumbent U.S. Senator Democrat from Cleveland, who's basically target number one for the Republican Party, really, this cycle in the election, even though we have statewide elections and everything else. Taking Sherrod Brown out is one of the key things that Ohio Republicans are trying to do. Now, I'll be the first to admit there were many inside the Republican establishment who weren't very happy with Josh Mandel. And they had gone out and encouraged, now I can't say recruited because, I mean, that actually, we can't necessarily, there's no documentation to prove it, but encouraged other people to run. And one of those people was a businessman from up in Northeast Ohio by the name of Mike Gibbons. Mike Gibbons is a multimillionaire. As a matter of fact, from what I heard recently, he's valued at over $100 million. He was in the race, but polling was showing that Josh Mandel had 52% support, and Mike Gibbons had 5%. So it was going to be a real uphill battle with Mandel in the race. But now that he's out, a lot of people started gravitating. I'm watching my social media with a bunch of the Tea Party conservatives and the libertarians and others. All of a sudden, everybody was, I like Mike.
Yeah.
Gibbons, that is. Not DeWine. We'll talk about that race in a minute. However, now there's another little shakeup because today, as we're recording this on a Thursday, later this morning on Thursday, you know, this will have already happened, you'll know about it. Jim Renacci, the congressman from Northeast Ohio who is running for governor and who's named a running mate, is set to announce that he's leaving the governor's race to go and file and run for the United States Senate nomination. Because he's being encouraged to do so by the White House, by President Trump, supposedly, or somebody, people inside the Trump White House, who are not sure about Gibbons and, you know, are seeing poll and looking at that polling and thinking that, you know, hey, I'm not sure that this is a guy we want to work with. But supposedly on Wednesday, Renacci went to D.C. to the White House, had a long series of meetings, and is today is supposed to announce that he's going to jump out of the governor's race and run for the United States Senate seat, which means that Mike Gibbons is back in a primary. Now, Mike already had another primary because there's a lady from the Mansfield area, and honestly, I'll be quite honest with you, I don't think she was even polling it. Like, I think she was actually polling a little bit better than Gibbons was. Let me go ahead and I should have looked this up before we got on, and I'm going to find her name, and I apologize that I don't have this already, but you know, this is one of those ones where, okay, why am I paying attention to this, right? Because we all thought that this was basically Josh Mandel's to lose. Her name is Melissa Akeson. Now, the other person is someone who, in the interest of full disclosure, you and I both know fairly well, Chuck. Don Eckert, who has been a candidate in the past for this Senate seat and for a couple of other seats, who's from the Grove City area. Don's a former legislative staff person who was a section chief in the Legislative Service Commission. He's a great economist. He knows budgets. He's a great guy, but he's jumped in. Now, whether or not he's going to get, you know, signatures and file on time, I don't know. But so there were these numbers. Now, Jim Renacci is declaring today. So that's going to be at least four. There's another piece of information that's out there that's getting confirmed that Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader in the United States Senate, the senator from Kentucky, and his team, including the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee chair, are recruiting author J.D. Vance. Now, nobody has heard of J.D. Vance unless you're really a Politico. Or you really, really like to read interesting nonfiction, because J.D. Vance is the author of a book called Hillbilly Elegy, and it's basically talking about all the struggles his family, you know, focused through his family as they came up from, I believe, from Kentucky into Ohio and through the Appalachians during the Depression and all the way up. And so it became a little cause celeb, you know, that we had an Ohio author who wrote this book that actually got some traction and, well, you know, may have gotten some interest from a potential presidential candidate. I think he was on Oprah, Chuck. And that's the other thing, and we'll talk about that in a minute, too, about this whole now recruit Oprah Winfrey to run for the Democratic nomination for president. We'll talk about that in a little bit when we talk about crazier things that are happening. So now we've got this big mix-up, so nobody knows who the Republican nominee is going to be for the U.S. Senate. Right now, it looks like Renacci would probably be the front-runner if he jumps over from the governor's race to the Senate race. But if McConnell has his way and recruits J.D. Vance, expect to see an awful lot of money coming in from the Republican Senate Leadership Committee, just like they did in Alabama.
Yeah, exactly.
Against Roy Moore, which honestly could shake up the thing enough and get enough people turned off that somebody like a Melissa Akeson or a Don Eckert, who nobody really knows about and who doesn't have a bunch of political baggage, might be able to slide in there. I doubt it seriously, but you never know. So that's created a bunch of furor right now. And, of course, the filing deadline is in early February. And these people have to, like, collect, I think it's 1,000 signatures. And there's a breakdown in Ohio law and the Constitution about how many signatures they have to have from so many counties, like a percentage in each county, in order to qualify to be on the ballot. It isn't just collect 1,000 signatures from the people that, you know, that are in your business or whatever. Since it's a statewide seat, it has to be a statewide representation of people wanting you to run. So we got that going. Well, that clears out. Since Renacci is jumping out of the governor's race, that gets it down in the Republican primary to a two-dog race. You have the team of Mike DeWine and John Husted, who basically is establishment heavy, they've combined. That's the ticket on their side. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of name ID. But insiders in Columbus were trying to convince Mary Taylor to jump out and run for this Senate seat, knowing that, you know, they could just push her to the side and, you know, good luck if you win or you don't win. She trumped their play. She said, there's no way I'm getting out of this gubernatorial race. I'm going to run. We're going to take you on. And by the way, I just announced my running mate. Now, this is an interesting thing, Chuck, because in the political world, there's not a lot of people who've heard of Mary Taylor's running mate. But in the conservative activist world, there's an awful lot of us who know, respect, and are excited about the naming of her running mate. Her running mate they announced yesterday, Nathan Estruth. Now, pay attention to that name, folks. Nathan Estruth. Nathan Estruth is an executive with Procter & Gamble in the Cincinnati area. And you're like, okay, so what does that mean for him being conservative? Nathan Estruth is one of the smartest strategists and tacticians I have ever met, Chuck. He has been in the inner circles of pretty much every real conservative elected officials run that you could possibly think of in Ohio and elsewhere. He is very good at what he does. He has a lot of business background, which means he comes with a lot of connections, not just in Ohio, not just nationally, but worldwide. And he'll bring a lot of funding into that race, which is the first thing that everybody complained, that Mary Taylor couldn't raise money. I guess she just showed you that she can find somebody who can raise money. Nathan has been a stalwart conservative. He has been with us on so many things. He's what we call a backroom guy. He likes to stay out of the limelight and work behind the scenes to craft good policies and to help organizations thrive and move forward and make positive changes in the culture. It was a fantastic pick. I can't be happier of who she picked, because I think it's going to be a game changer, because it's so outside the box that with Renacci jumping out, I think that many, many people, especially in the Liberty movement, should take a very close look at the Taylor Estruth campaign, because I think they're going to find a lot to like about it. Now, again, there's another situation, and I'm kind of wondering how this is going to play out, because I know that Taylor's been very good on Second Amendment issues, and I know that the most of the Second Amendment crowd early on had endorsed John Husted for governor, but then since Husted played the political game and then decided he'd fold his tent for governor in order to get what he thinks is a sure thing as waltzing in as lieutenant governor and waiting for Mike DeWine to get tired of being governor and then taking it himself. Well, the problem is that these gun groups, Mike, they can't stand the ground Mike DeWine trods upon. He has been an absolute nightmare for the pro-Second Amendment crowd for decades. They can't stand him. So the question is, are these gun groups in Ohio going to stand behind what they believe and endorse a candidate or team that is completely pro-Second Amendment, or are they going to swallow real hard, play the political game, play the, oh gosh, we think they're going to win, so we better not cross them, and hold the, and just say, well, we're endorsing half the ticket for DeWine and Husted. I really am wondering how that's going to play out. Because they've been, ever since this announcement that Husted was going to combine with DeWine, the Second Amendment groups in Ohio have been deadly silent. And honestly, I want to see what they're made of.
Well, they don't know how to play it. That's the real problem.
Well, the point is, Chuck, there's only one real way to play it.
Yeah, of course.
And that is, you stand for what you believe. And if your only thing you believe is making sure that you have got access to the table, you do exactly what they're doing right now. If you believe in the right of people to hold, in the Second Amendment sacrosanct, you stand on that principle, you denounce that little political game, and you go and you find another team that you can back. Or you get out of the. You just say, "We're just not going to get in this race anymore. We don't like this team, or we don't at least like half of this team, and we're getting out of it." And honestly, you know, people can disagree with me on that, but the point is that the first thing you say that, well, you got to back somebody, means that you are already owned by the political establishment, whether you want to be or not. If you feel like I've got to get in and back somebody because somebody's going to win, then back them all, you know? Hey, cover all your bets. Just say, we're going to back everybody, whether you're with us, against us, or whatever. We love you all. So, you know, we want to make sure that whoever wins, even if it's a surprise, we're sitting there looking like, hey, well, we were with you. Because honestly, Chuck, that's the thing that frustrates me. And I've been drilling into, you know, I work with a lot of the pro-life, pro-family conservative groups, and many of them have PACs and C4s, and they're looking and doing endorsements. I have been spending a lot of time with my folks basically saying, hold fire.
Don't jump right in.
Do not endorse until after the filing deadlines. I said, it sounds like, you know, you're losing. You're going to be outside looking in. I said, but no, what you need to do is make sure that they're going to actually have enough oomph to get actually filed on the ballot and run. And I said, and you don't even endorse until after you've given them questionnaires, and then you've personally screened the ones who passed the questionnaire. I said, you know, you don't just endorse from a questionnaire, because sometimes candidates and their teams know how to answer for certain organizations, know what the organization's looking for, and so they'll answer that way whether they believe it or not. It's when you set a person down in front of a screening panel and you start asking them hard questions and they can't turn and ask their staff or their campaign manager how to answer it, that's when you start finding out what they truly believe. And of course, as you found out when we did that thing when John Kasich was running, when you ask them a tough question, if they've got somebody there running interference for them, what'll happen is your question will get asked when nobody hears their answer.
Yeah, I want to be fair to the questioner. He asked that question because he had to fill time during it was a live broadcast, and they were off at the top of the hour for news and weather and all that junk, and he wanted to keep the audience engaged, so he asked him that question. Where essentially during a 3-minute break, John Kasich, and by the way, folks, if you ask the question correctly, this is what you'll find out what these guys are made of, which I did. Essentially, John Kasich stumbled, hem-hawed around, and essentially prevaricated for the entire 3 minutes. And at the end, he basically said, well, it is what it is. Because what I had done was exposed him as a phony on the Second Amendment, and also a phony on the so-called balanced budget, which he was supposedly responsible for, in which case there was no actual balanced budget. So he traded a gun control vote for a quote unquote balanced budget, which didn't exist. So, and essentially when he got called on it, he did what John Kasich does best. And that is, hey, look, Halley's Comet, tried to draw attention away from it. And to be fair to the questioner, he didn't let him do that. Too bad it got done while the radio audience couldn't hear it.
Right. It was done in such a way that it didn't get broadcast. And honestly, I think that's a problem as well. Now, okay, so basically, you know, you've got that going on. So there's all the stuff going on at state level. And of course, Richard Cordray on the Democrat side has announced that Betty Sutton, the former congresswoman from the Akron area, is going to be his running mate, which basically takes all the air out of the room for most of the other Democratic candidates, including Joe Schiavone, who I think has announced this morning that he's dropping out, or is planning on announcing that he's dropping out.
Yeah, it's coming.
Connie Pillage in the Cincinnati area, who may or may not drop out. Nan Whaley, the Democrat mayor of Dayton, who may or may not drop out, but likely they're both going to, because Cordray is going to basically take up all the air, the oxygen, which means all the money and the endorsements in the room are going to go to the Cordray because he's their darling. Now, Bill O'Neill, the sitting Ohio Supreme Court justice, whose claim to fame is that he likes to brag on Facebook about his sexual conquests, or at least he did that in an effort to get it out of the way and stop it from becoming an issue in his governor's race, ha ha ha, has announced his running mate of a, I think, a seventh grade teacher in Lorain City school system, which, you know, is one of those quirky little picks because Bill O'Neill's a quirky little guy. He's going to stay in the race, which, you know, is actually good, because I believe that people ought to get in the race, Chuck. I don't believe any candidate should just have the party has manufactured me a slick move to the nomination by clearing the field for me. I think, you know, I want to encourage people to run. There's a challenger right now who's looking to challenge a Republican who's basically gotten the field cleared for him in the, Ohio, treasurer's race. And this person's jumped in and is getting signatures and is going to, you know, give him a challenge because, hey, why should we let the party insiders pick who the people have to vote for? I agree with that.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it isn't that I don't like the person who's running. I think they're a fine individual. I think they've been a fairly, you know, regular person and voted okay on good things. And, you know, do I believe they love their family and, you know, and like mom, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and maybe they don't like Chevrolet. I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah.
but the point is that I don't feel that, you know, it's being, you know, a disloyal or, you know, Machiavellian to say, well, why shouldn't you have a primary? You know, why shouldn't other people file and run and give the voters a choice? Why not? You know, if you're strong enough and you're a good enough candidate, it won't matter that those challenges will not win. You will win because the people are liking you and understanding where you come from and believing it. And so everything should be fine. But if you start moaning and groaning about why, can't believe that you'd be, you know, these people coming in and I, you know, why couldn't I get in, you know, get the field cleared for me? Now, of course, this is in a race where the field was already cleared because there was a major primary challenge in that race and another race. And then all of a sudden, two people drop out, one each on the, there's two different establishment groups in Columbus that are basically ponying up candidates to try to win these statewide races. And it looks like, and I won't say that a deal was cut, but it's looking very curious because one person on Team A drops out in one race to give Team B guy the clear shot, and then the Team B guy on the other race drops out to give Team A guy a clear shot at these nominations. It looks a little too manufactured because they both dropped out within a day of each other. So I'm sure that it wasn't because of one single poll that came out there and showing them you just can't win 6 months out. It just doesn't work that
way. Yeah, you're talking about which race?
This would be the auditor's race and the treasurer's race. No, excuse me, the secretary of state's race and the treasurer's race. In the treasurer's race, it was Robert Sprague versus Clarence Mingo, and Mingo dropped out. And in the treasurer's, or excuse me, in the Secretary of State's race, it was Frank LaRose and Dorothy Palanda, and Palanda dropped out. But Mingo and Palanda were both being backed. One was being backed by Team A, and the other one was being backed by Team B, the two big establishment money groups in Columbus.
Yeah.
And they both drop out within a day of each other, leaving Team A's person in the one race and Team B's person in the other race with clear shots with no primary.
There's no collusion there at all, is there?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. That's the reason why I'm not saying a deal was cut, but I'm saying there is the implication that there may have been some discussion going on behind the scenes in order to help these individuals make these independent decisions at the same time.
It's called an appearance of wrongdoing.
And honestly, wrongdoing or right doing, I mean, that's just how the political machine plays the game in Columbus and in D.C. and other places. I mean, it's the reason why Mitch McConnell's out trying to recruit J.D. Vance for the U.S. Senate race, because they don't want a Jim Renacci or obviously a Bob Gibbons. Mike Gibbons to win this nomination for the U.S. Senate seat. Now, how they think J.D. Vance is as a no name, I mean, he's a venture capitalist, so maybe he's got some money. Maybe they can get him to write a big bunch of checks to the Republican Senate Leadership Committee. But how they think they're going to get him over the hump in November against Sherrod Brown, whose statewide name ID is probably bigger than Mike DeWine's, I have no earthly idea. You would think that, okay, even let's just say Gibbons. I mean, the guy's got his own money, so he could buy a lot of name ID. He's got support, it looks like, a lot of the liberty groups in Ohio because we have the hardcore conservatives and then we have the not quite so hardcore conservatives. The not quite so hardcore conservatives are all gravitating around Gibbons, and so is the libertarians, you know, who vote Republican. I just don't understand the math. I mean, at least, you know, Gibbons is from Northeast Ohio, so you have a chance of splitting Sherrod Brown's base if Gibbons can catch traction. I'm not sure what you get with J.D. Vance other than him writing big checks to the Republican Senate Leadership Committee. Maybe they need him there because they spent $32 million trying to knock Roy Moore out. Maybe they're trying to rebuild their
car. Yeah, that's part of it, I think. I'll be quite honest. What game McConnell has in mind, I'm not sure. He may be trying to throw the match.
Well, and there's the other side of that coin that, you know, he's so anti-Trump that because Trump's recruiting Renacci, supposedly, that McConnell's got to recruit his own controllable guy in order to make sure that they can squelch the Trump support.
The Trump agenda, yeah.
And the Trump agenda for another candidate. And honestly, if that's the case, then Mitch McConnell probably should have a vote of no confidence thrown against him by the Senate Republican caucus, because that's putting their caucus in jeopardy, that's putting their leadership in jeopardy, and that's wasting money that could be used for other races to help incumbents or to win marginal seats against Democrats.
Well, I mean, let's face it, Mitch McConnell successfully killed off a Republican in Alabama and then tried to blame it on Steve Bannon. No.
But, you know, Chuck, that's not endemic to just the national political scene, as we're seeing today, and you and I both looked at the article. There's an article from our friends over at Third Rail Politics about the fact that an appointment has just been made to the vacant House seat that was left open when former Representative Wes Goodman came out that he was basically carrying on illegitimate sexual hijinks with men in his office, and he stepped down in disgrace. But the House Republican Caucus, and by that I mean Speaker Cliff Rosenberger and Finance Chairman Ryan Smith, who's trying to win the Speaker's race next term, basically engineered putting in as the appointee for this seat one Riordan McLean. Now, folks have never heard that name, I'm sure. Matter of fact, the vast majority of folks in Columbus have never heard that name, unless his father happened to mention him as being proud of his son for whatever he was doing. because Riordan McLean's son is the former member of the House from that district that Wes Goodman won when he was termed out, Jeff McLean. So he's the son of Jeff McLean. And the only other thing that goes, that basically, is according to Third Rail's analysis, the only other reason is because he swore to cast a vote for Ryan Smith for Speaker in this, in a very contested Speaker's race that doesn't even happen, Chuck, until the end of this year after the November elections. But if you can get your person in and you can get them appointed before a primary, now there's going to be a big primary in this district because there's a former state representative, Steve Reinhardt, who had that seat before Jeff McLean, who was the runner-up to Wes Goodman in a primary 2 years ago. So Reinhardt didn't get the nod. You have the chairman of the Mora County Commissioners, Tom Whiston, who is going to be running again, who came in third, you know, during that run with Goodman. You have the current Morrow County auditor, who the Republican screening committee, who was appointed in the House to screen these candidates, she was the person they recommended, Patricia Davies. She was a former U.S. infantry officer in the Army.
West Point grad,
West Point grad. She's the auditor. They were very impressed with her. But no, none of those people. And of course, there were like, there's eight people, other people, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, eight other people who screened for this appointment. But at the end of the day, Riordan McLean, mainly because his father was the former member and that he's committed to voting for Smith for Speaker, gets the nod. And of course, Connor Brown, who writes for Third Rail Politics, basically said, Riordan McLean just became the luckiest guy in Ohio politics. He folded over eight other better known and more qualified candidates to win a coveted appointment to the Ohio House seat. It's like, it wasn't due to the management lessons he gained from running the local Menards, because he's looking at his bio. And it wasn't from learning how to turn your cash into gold, or I think he means gold into cash, through his past 4 years working customer service at SD Bullion. And that's one of those, or those outfits that basically bring your gold in and will give you like spot cash for it, because then they give you like a small percentage of what the gold value actually is and what you bring into them. Okay. And then they turn around and send it to the smelter and they get like big money for it.
I assume,
they get what the spot is.
Yeah. I assumed that they were selling bullion, not buying gold jewelry and melting it down. Okay.
Well, usually when an organization uses bullion or something, you know, yes, you can buy stuff, but they're also usually selling it as well. You know, they're buying it and selling it both. So
yeah.
But anyhow, so he worked customer service for them, and basically says it wasn't due to the fact that he never made a campaign contribution, ran for office, or served in any elected or appointed office. It wasn't even for the fact that the only Facebook post he's made in 3 years is, quote, "It's not about me, it's about Jesus," unquote. Now, for me, detracting point. I just hope that maybe in the last 3 years he's deepened that theological understanding and wants to apply it to politics. that's what I hope. But they said that basically, you know, it was because he was a yes vote for Speaker. And the fact that what it's looking like is that the other Speaker candidate, Larry Householder from Perry County, who was the former House Speaker years ago, has a better machine and is being much more successful at recruiting candidates to run in these open seats and for ones that are being term limited out. And it's looking like after the November election, that Householder will probably become the Speaker because he's going to have more votes. But if it so happens that you appoint this person before the primary, that allows, by the rules of the party, for the Ohio House Republican Campaign Committee, OROC, to open the Republican coffers and spend money in a primary. Because usually they won't spend money in a primary, especially if there's not an incumbent. But if there's an incumbent, they get to dump the war chest. So it looks like a Mitch McConnell's getting pulled by Cliff Rosenberger and his pick to succeed him, Ryan Smith, of let's endorse this guy because he's going to be loyal to me, and then we'll spend a bunch of money to make sure that Davies or whoever else or Reinhardt or somebody else can't beat him in a primary, so that we engineer getting our vote in for you for Speaker. Now, given the fact that this appointment goes against what the screening committee recommended, that's sort of what it's really looking
like. Oh, yeah. Yeah. By the way, SD Bullion is a sales.
Okay, so they sell. They're not buying. Okay, they're selling. Okay. All right. Well, good for them. And, you know, yes. I'm a coin guy, so I like coins. So it's fun. You know, I'm seeing some stuff on here on their website. I just pulled it up myself that I'm thinking, yeah, I could possibly want to buy from them because their prices look pretty good.
Yeah, that's their whole deal. They sell top notch gold at the lowest possible price.
And you take a look at some of the places, they get a lot of foreign coinage, you know, silver and gold coins, and that's cool because that's kind of where I'm at. I like foreign numismatics better than I like, you know, just sitting around looking at the same old stuff from the American side with gold eagles and buffaloes and all that other fun stuff. I kind of like looking at, all the different artistic things that different countries put on their coinage, which I think it's kind of fun.
Yeah, director of sales for a bullion sales company and manager of Menards is not necessarily qualification for to suddenly step into a state representative position.
Yeah, that's true. It's not. But the point is that, you know, being a loyal vote for the guy who's trying to get to continue on the legacy of the current speaker, because he's the hand-picked guy for the current speaker to take over the seat, you know, that has a lot of moxie, I guess. So it's just sad. But there you go. That's part of what we're dealing with, because it's not just endemic to Mitch McConnell and the National Republican Party. The state party, you know, wants to be like their big uncle and do the same thing, sadly. So you got that going on. Now, of course, there's another seat that they're getting ready to fill, but it's very interesting to find out whether or not they're going to fill it before the primary, because that was the seat that was open because the current incumbent, Rob McCauley, was appointed to the Ohio Senate to fill Cliff Heights' seat, who resigned in disgrace over a sexual impropriety. And you've got a former rep who probably is going to be loyal to Larry Householder, who's basically the far and away front runner for that seat by the name of Jim Hoops. Jim was a four-term House member who was fairly conservative. I mean, you wouldn't consider him like a movement guy or your first-line guy you go to get stuff done as conservative. But he was a consistent vote, and he was very much consistent, I believe, with Larry Householder. So, therefore, you don't hear them appointing Jim Hoops to the seat before a primary. They want an open primary there. They won't appoint anybody. They're going to appoint the winner of the primary to that seat, most likely, hoping that they can get up in there and you know, create enough distraction in order to get somebody other than Jim Hoops in as the representative in that district. And we'll keep report on that as we move up through May and figure out what's going on. So, but Chuck, that's some of the things that are going on. And of course, you know, Ohio's not alone. You know, I mentioned the sexual improprieties of both Wes Goodman and Cliff Height. Well, it seems like that's become the new theme in 2018 in politics. And that is that you're starting to see all over the map, and it's both parties, although the ones that most recently have been more Republicans than not. You're starting to see this whole trend of where the and whether it's generated by the Me Too movement, the Harvey Weinstein thing, which I think is part of it. But I think what's happening is people have become more sensitized. And the more sexualized our culture is becoming, the more sensitized people are to the fact that there may be just something not right about, you know, just having a licentious libertine kind of culture out there. It's great for the movies and entertainment, but when we take it over to real life, then all of a sudden it becomes problematic. Well, it is problematic. I'm not discounting that. So what we have is in the last week or so since we've last broadcast, Chuck, you have an Idaho representative who has committed suicide because he was going to be stepped down. He was being investigated for sexual improprieties, and it comes to find out now that he's taken his own life, his ex-wife has come out and has basically, you know, spilled the beans. He was sexually assaulting young girls, including a family member. for years. This supposedly some of this abuse went on for 10 years while he was also, and he was a third term member in the Idaho House. So you've got that situation. You just announced today that the very fairly newly elected governor of Missouri, Eric Greitens, has come clean that he had an illicit extramarital affair with his hairdresser, in which he had taken her into a basement, basically tied her up and blindfolded her, bound her up, you know, into that kind of stuff, I suppose, and taken photos of her and basically said that if you say anything about us having this little, you know, tete-a-tete, these photos will go public. So, in other words, blackmail and extortion. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens to Greitens, because this has just come out. Another situation in Florida, which has already had a situation where some members of the Florida legislature have been busted for having, you know, illicit sexual activity going on in the Florida House. You've had two representatives, a Republican member. Both, I think they're both from the Miami area, Republican member, female, and a Democrat member, male, who have, it's just been announced, were carrying on an extramarital affair with each other because they're both married to other people. So that's, you know, so I think what's happening is, Chuck, is the theme in 2018 is what is done in the darkness will ultimately come to the light.
Wow.
Which I think is a biblical theme. If
I
you
believe
think
so,
it.
Yes,
it is a it's biblical.
Like your sin will find you out.
Well, yeah, there's that too. But again, and I think the more these people are in the spotlight, the faster it's coming out now because people. And I think the only reason this came out was because I think the woman finally decided enough is enough, and she was going to say something about it, and so. You know, now it's coming. Of course, he didn't put out these photos. Supposedly, he apologized to her and he had deleted the photos, you know, well back when. But just the fact that he basically, and of course, she's admitted that, yes, they did have a extramarital, you know, fling. And she was married and he's married. So, you know, there we go again. But, you know, you have this situation that's kind of where these things are going. Now, honestly, it's getting to the point, and it's almost getting as bad in politics with all this sexual dalliance and these sexual, you know, exploitations and sexual harassment, you know, that we've seen even in Ohio, that you just wish for just a good old-fashioned political scandal to get away from all this sex stuff. We've got one.
Wait, boy, have we.
It's developing right now, and I'm turning it way over to you, and you're going to basically run, I think, for the rest of the program on what's going on here.
Well, I've only had a short little time to kind of digest this, so.
Well, that's all the time I've given you to talk.
That's true. That's okay, because this story will be developing.
Yes, it will.
I very often read a guy named Sundance who posts at a place called the Conservative Treehouse, and we'll post a link to this article. But it's called A Political Battle Over Dossiers, FISA Warrants, and Surveillance Clouds a Much Bigger Story. And that, a truer headline has not existed. There's a lot of talk about this dossier and that it was used to gain a FISA warrant. What's FISA? Well, it's a national security warrant that you use, to do things like it was originally designed to catch organized crime figures, drug dealers, weapons dealers, drug dealers, that kind of thing. And it's used as part right now of national security apparatus. What it is essentially a warrant that, in which you go and, use information you've already gathered to get a warrant to use that information and to gather more information. Okay. Now, if you recall, part of the problem here, the Trump dossier, this all centers around the quote-unquote Trump/Steele dossier. Well, The Steele dossier is the name it's being used by these days, because the media is trying to get away from the Trump thing because this dossier is blowing up in their face. And if you recall what it was, it was this document that purported to prove that Donald Trump had engaged in some kind of weird fetish type behavior in Russia while he was there. If you recall that he urinated on a bed that Barack Obama and Michelle had slept in, supposedly.
It wasn't him that he'd hired prostitutes to do it.
Yeah, well, he was in the room with prostitutes.
Yeah, he was in the room while they did that.
They did it. Yeah, that was the accusation. Well, first of all, that's an absurdity on its face. The second of all, there's absolutely no proof this ever took place. However, you've got guys like John McCain who got hoodwinked into, he was easy to hoodwink. He was looking for something as well, that provided this to the FBI. Well, why do we say hoodwinked? The whole point of the dossier was to get a special prosecutor involved. Now, this all happened before Trump was president. And maybe before he was a candidate. Nonetheless, it was supposed to be a character assassination kind of deal. Well, it's now blowing up in people's faces because the group that put the dossier together was a group called Fusion GPS. And the person who put it together was a guy named Christopher Steele, who was a former British intelligence officer. And he was hired to put this thing together. And there was, for a time, they were saying that it was put together by Republican opposition to Trump's candidacy. Now it has all switched over to the Democratic National Committee. If you want my opinion, both are correct. I think both guys like Peter Singer and the Democratic National Committee were involved in having this thing put together. I think this, honestly, there was some Republican opponent involvement in this. However, the shift has gone over to the Democratic National Committee paying for it, and also the FBI paying for part of it. Well, why is that important? Because it's looking like the FBI and the national security apparatus was used by both Democrats and Republicans as a way to derail Donald Trump's candidacy for president of the United States. That was the entire purpose of this thing. Okay, that's kind of the catch-up. One of the main bones of contention is that there is a FISA warrant. In other words, that this warrant exists. The warrant with the information from the dossier was taken to a judge as proof that further monitoring of Donald Trump's personal communications, emails, phone calls, any form of tweets, any form of communication, like tweets aren't really private, but private messages, instant messenger, that kind of thing, should be looked at and scrutinized for collusion with Russia during the campaign for presidency against Hillary Clinton. So, supposedly, the information that was gathered based on this dossier was taken to a judge and a FISA warrant was issued. Well, we have in this article, we have some very important questions being asked by the author of this article. And he gives you some very good background on this whole thing, and I've really shorthanded it. So make sure you go out and read the article again. We're putting out the link to it. All right. This is a quote from the article. After he gives you kind of the background, all these people, NSA Director Admiral Rogers, we've got guys like James Clapper, James Comey. Believe me, there's a lot of, and it's complex. There's a lot of information being spread around. Okay, here's an important quote from the article. It says, important in red letters. We, meaning the author and people who are doing the research on this story, are no longer taking it for granted a FISA warrant was ever given to the DOJ, because no one can prove a FISA warrant exists. In other words, information was gathered on the Trump campaign without a warrant, if this is true. Heck, no one can even point to anything that directly claims a FISA warrant has been requested. There are inferences, suspicions, media reports based on anonymous leaks, but no direct or reasonable evidence beyond innuendo. We are 18 months past the reported origination dates, and there's not a single official who will state a 2016 FISA warrant was applied for or granted. Therefore, we must begin to question that basic assumption. In other words, this is the foundation on which the story is reported. And it appears that the foundation may be made of sand rather than solid rock. Okay. That said, the inability to prove the existence of a FISA warrant does not prove a FISA warrant doesn't exist. Look, pure logic at work here.
Right.
Additionally, the cloud of uncertainty conveniently, perhaps purposely, makes it challenging to outline the liars within the intelligence community. Do you get what he's saying here? If the information is nebulous, then really it can't be pointed to as anyone that lied, because there's nothing solid to call anybody a liar on.
Right, which is dissemination by degree.
Yes. All right, when it comes to questions around the 2016 DOJ FBI FISA warrant, a key approach to finding the truth is to apply the scientific method during the research. Question our underlying assumptions and reverse the hypothesis. Exactly, that is the scientific method, if you're doing real scientific research. All right, example, can we prove the non-existence of the FISA warrant? All right, here are bullet points. Well, there is direct and attributable evidence that no FISA warrant existed. Second bullet, there is no direct and attributable evidence a FISA warrant did exist. Okay. However, the article goes on, the absence of evidence is not evidence of its absence. And any scientist can tell you that just because you can't find evidence, absence of evidence does not necessarily mean there's no evidence there. It just means you haven't found it yet.
Right.
Just because we cannot prove a FISA warrant exists doesn't prove the non-existence of the FISA warrant, which, as you will see, is a critical piece of the puzzle. It is important, heck, critical, to underscore that all of the currently available evidence indicates that two intelligence units participated in the majority of the illegal activity surrounding the 2016 Trump operation: the Department of Justice National Security Division and the FBI Counterintelligence Division. If you have read the prior explanation about compartmented intelligence and how the process was used to hide illegal intelligence activity, and there is a link to an article in there, and I would suggest you read it, you will more easily connect the dots on how this was strategically used. Mm-hmm. In other words, okay, what's he talking about, Barry? There's a magic word that is connected to something like this.
Okay, I'm not following.
It's
what
a conspiracy.
Thinking? Conspiracy. Oh, well, brush it. Collusion, conspiracy. Yes, exactly.
Okay, no, it's a conspiracy within the intelligence community.
Right.
To illegally gather evidence for political weaponization. In other words, the FBI was being weaponized to use against a specific presidential candidate. That's the whole point here that he's getting at. Now, why do I use the term conspiracy? Doesn't that make, it means you're paranoid? No, when evidence of a conspiracy exists, it means that there's possibly a conspiracy involved. And a lot of this evidence, we're not going to be able to play everything here. There are several minute long interviews that we will not be able to fit in here, that kind of thing. And I would love to play you the tapes, but the tapes are attached to this article. Again, it's on our page. Read it. All right. On March 20th, 2017, FBI Director James Comey testified to Congress. During that congressional testimony, Comey was asked why the FBI director did not inform congressional oversight senior leadership about the counterintelligence operation that began in July of 2016. Director Comey said he did not tell congressional oversight he was investigating presidential candidate Donald Trump because the director of counterintelligence, W.H. Bill Priestap, suggested he not do so.
I was just about to say that one more time.
Yes. FBI Director Comey said he did not tell congressional oversight he was investigating presidential candidate Donald Trump because the director of counterintelligence, W.H. Bill Priestap, suggested he not do so.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, first of all, that is throwing Priestap under the bus.
Oh, that's true.
Because Comey, as the director of the FBI, knew he had a duty to inform oversight what was going on in closed-door executive session. All right. Now, if you'll recall, there was somebody, a congressman, who walked some information over to the White House and to let him know what was going on, and he was pilloried. Well, there's a reason he let him know, because it was becoming obvious that what had happened was that Comey, in conspiracy with other members of guys like Clapper, were running an illegal operation with the intent of torpedoing the Trump presidency. Okay. Which is why James Comey, by the way, got fired.
Exactly.
And deservedly so. FBI Director James Comey is stating on the record that the FBI counterintelligence operation was happening without oversight, and that lack of oversight was intentional. From the article. However, for the sake of this review, pay attention to his remarks. Okay, that is the embedded video. And since you haven't heard it, I'm going to have to give you these details sort of extemporaneously. Notice how Director Comey avoids mentioning the 2016 DNI James Clapper, DNI Director of National Intelligence. Basically, what he said was that DNI was not informed. The Director of National Intelligence, who was James Clapper, was not informed of a supposed counterintelligence operation. Okay, why was Clapper not informed? Essentially to keep it intentionally hidden from Congress. The obfuscation about James Clapper might not seem like a big deal, and almost everyone missed it at the time, and when you watch the interview, you'll see what he means by that. However, in hindsight, it is another critical part of the evidence against James Comey. If there was a FISA warrant issued against the Trump campaign or Trump officials by the FBI, Counterintelligence Unit, or DOJ National Security Division, James Clapper would have to be notified of it. Now, how do we know that? There's another interview in here that states unequivocally, it's James Clapper saying, if there was one of these, I would have to be informed. Now, Comey says, no, we didn't necessarily have to inform him. Clapper says, oh, yes, they did. And he states unequivocally in two different interviews that are embedded in this article that no FISA warrant existed. What does that mean? That means the basic, the basic assumption of the news media.
Yes.
Is that there was a FISA warrant and it discovered all this stuff. And what?
If there was no FISA warrant, then you're looking at criminal activity.
You're looking at criminal activity and the weaponized use of the FBI as a counterintelligence operation against a presidential campaign.
Exactly.
Now, unfortunately, I would love to go further into this. We can't.
We'll have to do that next time.
We'll have to do it next time. But you really need, folks, to go out and read this article because it destroys the entirety of the meme that there was a FISA warrant and collusion was discovered from listening to these this intelligence that was gathered. Okay. Sorry, we had such little time. We had other, you know, it's, unfortunately, we have a one-hour-long program, and we've got 3 hours worth of material here. And so, that being said, here's what I can say about this. You know what we think, and we want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.